welcome to the 388th episode of the So Video Games Podcast, where I talk about any game at all, including new stuff, old stuff, and anything in between. If I am playing it, I'll be talking about it. Today, I'm recording on May 12th, 2024. My name is Brad Galloway. I am not only the host of the show, but I'm also the editor of GameCritics.com. As per usual, today's show is going to kick off with housekeeping, where I discuss tidbits, news items, industry happenings, and basically anything randomly game adjacent. Before we get to that, though, I guess a happy Mother's Day to any of you mothers who are listening to the podcast air, or if you know a mother, I guess wish them a happy birthday. A mother-like person, a person who fulfills the role of a mother, anybody remotely like that. I don't think it has to be limited to biological mother by any means. It can be adoptive. It could be just a good found mom. Could be anybody. A friend who feels like a mom, someone else's mom, any mom, anybody like that. So wish them a happy holiday if you wish. It's funny because I actually hate holidays. I know that some people think that's really weird, but in my family, we did not treat holidays well, and I think I kind of picked up that aversion to them. Maybe somebody else out there can relate, but it was always like this big thing when I was growing up where holidays were coming up and there was like all these expectations. Like as a kid, I would hope that like, oh, maybe I'm going to, and not necessarily Mother's Day, of course, I didn't get presents for Mother's Day, but I mean like birthdays or Christmas or something, where I'd be like, oh, I really hope that I get like so-and-so for Christmas. And, you know, I'd fill out like a Christmas list and give it to my folks and everything. And they were just like, my folks just couldn't be arsed, right? Like to borrow a term from my friends across the water, they just didn't give a shit. And so they would end up with something, but it was very rarely the thing that I wanted. And so there was a lot of disappointment for me. Not like I want to sound super privileged or anything, but like when you're hoping for like a He-Man figure and you get like a screwdriver, it kind of like puts the damper on your Christmas morning, right? Kind of the same thing with birthdays and stuff like that. My parents didn't know me very well growing up, despite many attempts for me to try to get them to know me. We just didn't connect. Sometimes parents and kids just don't connect like that. And I think in my family, it was like that. And so growing up, birthdays were awkward because they would get me something that I had no idea why they got it for me. Or like one time I got a box of cereal and some nail clippers for my birthday. And I'm like, man, that's really cool. I was upset, obviously. And then they were upset that I was upset, right? Like, I should be grateful I got anything at all. And why are you so upset about this? And you got something. We remembered your birthday. And what's the big deal? And, you know, it just kind of became this really shitty, like, vibe. And I eventually just learned to hate all holidays because there was going to be a lot of expectation on both sides where my expectations, and not like I needed, like, a bunch of stuff, but just that they would know me, right? Like, when you know someone, you get them something that really fits them. And it doesn't have to be, like, a big ticket item. I'm not talking about lots of money, but, like, you know, if you know somebody really likes daisies or something and you get them a daisy, they're like, oh, you remember it. I like daisies. And that's the kind of thing that speaks to them, right? It doesn't have to be like $1,000, you know, some extravagant thing or whatever. Just those little gifts that show that somebody knows you and cares about you. And, you know, like, for example, my son and I, we just finished watching Star Trek The Next Generation. And there's this one actress in the background. She was on the bridge a few times. And my son just like, it sounds so dumb and petty, but like he hated her haircut like so bad. And every time she would show up, he would like be like, oh my God, it's bad haircut lady. And like, it would just be like this like running joke in her family, right? And so after we finished the whole series, I got him a mug with a picture of that exact lady. And it took me a while to track her down, but there was, you know, Star Trek is a big thing. You could find it online. So I found a picture of the haircut lady and I made him a mug with her picture on it because it was like funny, right? But it showed that I paid attention. And even though he like hated her hair, it was still like, hey, we watched Star Trek together and this is a thing that's commemorating that. And, you know, I noticed that you didn't like her hair and I thought it was funny and we thought it was funny. It was a joke. And here's this little thing. So that's the kind of thing, like, you know, getting a little something like that, I think, is really the best kind of gift. And so not getting those over and over and over really like drove me to be very averse to holidays. Like, I don't like Christmas. I don't like my birthday. I don't like anything. And I tend to not celebrate holidays, which sucks because my wife, when she was growing up, she didn't celebrate any holidays at all because of her whack-ass parents. And so she really likes holidays now. So that's always something difficult. I need to really work on myself and overcome that past trauma because I really do want to celebrate those with my wife, and she deserves to have good holidays. And I don't want to pass my trauma down to my kids. And so I definitely have some work to do. But anyway, I bring that up because today is one of those days where I really had to push myself to like do something for Mother's Day because, you know, my wife's a great mom. She's an amazing mom. She's an amazing wife, amazing partner, amazing friend. I love her so much. just celebrated 19 years of marriage, and she should have a celebration. But it's a struggle, you know, it's a struggle to kind of like get over that. So anyway, don't know why I went off on that tangent, but it was just something on my mind today and figured I would peel back the curtain a little bit and get a mind inside this particular podcaster. So there you go. Hope you learned a little bit about me. Hopefully your holidays growing up were better than mine were, and hopefully you're having some good ones now. And again, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. Sorry I ran on your parade with my sad story. All right, anyway, moving on. Let's get to housekeeping proper. What do I have on the agenda here? Let's see. May 8th, which was 4 days ago by the time of recording this, was the one-year anniversary of Darkest Dungeon 2. So happy birthday, Darkest Dungeon 2. Happy birthday to Red Hook Studios, all the good people over there. Darkest Dungeon, the first one, is one of my favorite games of all time. I played it like a bajillion hours. I did everything in it. I love it so much. Really excited for Darkest Dungeon 2, but if you listen to the show, you know the best time to play any game is at least 6 months after release, if not longer, and that's exactly true in this case as well. It released a while ago on PC, first in early access, and I believe it's been in 1.0 for a while, but you know, they've had multiple patches, multiple rebalance, multiple redesigns. There's been a ton of new content added. There's been all sorts of stuff, new features, new modes, everything. And so they're announcing a console port for later in the year. I'm guessing it before Christmas, hopefully. So again, it'll be like, you know, 8, 9, 10 months by the time that finally drops, and it'll be in much better shape. I won't have to put up with like wild difficulty spikes or, you know, maybe some designs that they reconsidered or anything like that. So this is one game that I'm really looking forward to, and I really want the best possible experience, so I don't want to trudge through the early access stuff or the 1.0 stuff. Looking forward to it. But regardless, happy birthday / anniversary to Red Hook and all of the people who worked on Darkest Dungeon 2. Moving on, some Helldivers 2 news, besides the fact that the new Polar Equipment Battle Pass dropped a couple days ago, which has a pretty nice submachine gun and an okay assault rifle. A really good grenade too. I love the grenade. So there was that big kerfuffle a little while ago about Sony launching Helldivers 2, which has been easily one of the runaway success stories of the year. They launched it on PSN and PC, and it just took off. It was on everybody's lips. Everybody's playing it. Everybody's got 100 hours into it, myself included. And then Sony decided to do a dirty trick on folks and say that after launch, I mean, all these months after launch, after the game has become so popular and big, they said, oh, well, anybody who was on PC who did not have a PSN membership will have to get a PSN membership if they want to keep playing. And this is after people have bought the game, been playing the game, put hundreds of hours into the game, you know, unlocked all sorts of stuff. Rightfully so, many people were incredibly mad about this, and they started downvoting the game and sending a lot of hate to the developers, which was absolutely unnecessary because this was a Sony thing. This was not an Arrowhead thing. So they were getting a lot of hate, which was not really, should never have been sent their way, right? So big problem, huge uproar. People were upset. And then Sony publicly said, okay, wait, we fucked up. We're gonna undo that. So anybody who had bought the game prior, and you know, specifically PC, and who did not have a PSN account, you don't need a PSN account. That's fine. We're gonna let it go. We made a bad undo, reset, restart, reboot. Just go back to what you were doing. Which sounds great. And in fact, initially, most people were like, wow, this is an amazing turn of events. We all expected Sony to double down and be all corporate and shit. And then they actually listened to feedback and they decided to let it go and just let all those PSN subscriptions, which nobody had in the first place, to not push for those because the game is already like such a runaway hit. It's like gonna easily be on everybody's top 10 list at the end of the year. You know, they shouldn't harsh that mellow. They should ride this wave of success. Good for them for finally listening to the fans. But it turned out a day later, Sony pulled another dirty trick. So they did not require, apparently they didn't require anybody to have a PSN account if they already bought the game. But after they made that announcement, they, I'm laughing at this because it's so stupid. They stopped the game from being on sale in any country where PSN was not an option. So what that means is it was delisted from Steam in about 75 different territories. So everybody thought, oh, great, I can keep buying Helldivers. I'll get in on this. My friends say it's a fun game. But they're like, yoinks, no, actually, no, we're not going to let you buy it anymore. So I think this was just their like dirty, underhanded way of trying to get their way anyway. To eventually force people who did not have access. Because the issue was, some people were saying, well, listen, Sony, You put your game up for sale on PC, which is like a worldwide platform, and PSN is not available in every territory. So a lot of people who bought Helldivers would not even have had the chance to buy PSN. Therefore, fuck you, because this was your fault. And Sony's like, okay, cool. We will simply not sell it in those territories anymore. So I think that was dirty business. I think Sony did a great thing at first, then they fucked up. Now they looked like they were doing a good thing, and now they're fucking up again. So basically, that's where we're at right now. 75 territories. It is no longer for sale in those areas, which sucks for those players, because come on, Sony. Like, it's really poor form. And just to get on my soapbox for a minute, if you're going to launch a game like that across the world and have it be a runaway success, just enjoy the success. Like, don't try to do your, like, you know, get everybody in the ecosystem and we're going to get PSN all over the place. That horse is out of the barn. You can't put it back in. Genie's out of the bottle, right? Like, just let it go and try better next time. You know, it's just shitting all over everybody's parade like this is just really, really bad for them. I'm very disappointed with them. Speaking of developers and bad form, Microsoft is fucking up hardcore recently with the announcement of layoffs. They, on Twitter, announced that they were going to be closing Tango Gameworks, Alpha Dog Games, Roundhouse Studios, and Arkane. I either believe they're located in Austin. Is it called Arkane Austin or just Arkane Studios? I forget. But anyway, you know, there's a lot of stuff to do about this. And Microsoft is a pretty rich company, as everyone knows, one of the richest companies in the world. And so many people were like, well, Jesus, why can't you just float these guys for a little while? I guess there shouldn't be that much of a money crunch when you've got like $20 billion in profits. You can probably let people slide. For example, with Arkane Studios, their most recent and I guess also last game was Redfall, this kind of like disastrous multiplayer vampire shooter. We covered it here on the show a while ago, and it was just not great. I mean, there was like some okay ideas going on there, but like none of them really came to fruition. I really didn't enjoy it. Carlos, I think, played it longer than I did, but I don't think he really enjoyed it either. And, you know, a lot of people were like, well, you don't make a good game, then you don't get to keep your studio open, which I sort of get, but also I think it's kind of unfortunate because Arkane was bought by Microsoft. And from what people say, like, I don't have a confirmed report on this, but a lot of people said that despite the fact that Redfall was initially a concept that Arkane wanted to run with, word on the street is that Microsoft really pushed them to take it in different directions, probably a lot of directions that Arkane didn't want to take it. Because honestly, if you look at Arkane's output, like online multiplayer shooter was like nowhere in their gameography. And I think it's kind of a stretch to think that that's what they were going after initially. Apparently Microsoft needed to fill a hole in one of their, you know, release spreadsheets, and they needed online multiplayer shooter. And they're like, Arkane, you're up. So, you know, I'm not there. I can't say for a fact, but that's what I heard. And, you know, it turned out to be a shit show. That was not Arkane's strength. The game was really not great. It didn't sell well. It was on Game Pass, I believe, but it was just kind of miserable. So they're closed, and they went out on a down note, which blows. Tango Gameworks, their most recent game was Hi-Fi Rush, which I didn't personally care for, but it won lots of awards. Lots of people really liked it. It was on tons of Game of the Year lists. And if that doesn't do enough to keep you afloat, then I don't know what did. And you know, some people are like, well, it didn't sell that much. I mean, okay, cool, I get that. But like, if we are an industry that absolutely doesn't care about awards, if all we care about is sales and literally nothing else, then I think we're in a pretty poor area, because that's going to lead to developers playing it really safe. We're going to be like even scrutinizing numbers even more than we already do, and ignoring the artistry, the sophistication, the creation that goes into some games. And honestly, some games take a while to develop. If all you're counting is like the initial sell through on like day one, you know, you're going to be disappointed, because not every game is going to sell bananas, especially when you consider how much competition is out there. When you consider there's a lot of forever games that some people just never stop playing, like, you know, Fortnite or Minecraft or Roblox or whatever. Whenever people get their forever game, that really cuts down on the amount of time they have, not to mention the amount of money, because, you know, they're going to be putting money towards other things. They got their one forever game, so, and times are tight for everyone, so they're going to, you know, buy food, they're going to pay their bills, they're going to pay rent rather than buy a bunch of other games if they got one game that they really like. And so I think you can't really count on day one like that. And also, I think expectations are too high. So if a great game like Hi-Fi Rush, which, not great to me, but a lot of people consider it to be great, and I'm willing to believe that, if a game like that, which does well, has a lot of good positive energy, gets a lot of awards, seems to be a favorite of a lot of people, doesn't keep you afloat because it just straight up didn't sell enough numbers, then I think maybe we need to relook at the numbers. And also, I think we do need to make space for games which may not initially be a huge breakaway hit, but that are good, that bring something to the table, that do bring value. And also a lot of games develop audiences over time. Some games have a really long tail. So, you know, maybe some games that develop over 1 month, 6 months, a year, maybe some YouTuber picks it up in a couple months. Maybe somebody discovers it, maybe an important podcaster, or maybe some review comes out or something. You never know. You never know when something could heat back up again. And then, you know, you've got yourself a hit in your hands. So I think it's just really shameful that these folks are getting laid off in general. And this is just like the tip of the iceberg. There's been so many other layoffs recently over the last couple months, you know, just and even before that. So my heart goes out to all the folks who are laid off. I hope that they all find new jobs and land on their feet. And I really wish that Microsoft would get its shit together. From all accounts, it seems like leadership at Microsoft is a shambles right now. You know, they bought a bunch of studios, didn't really do much with them, broke up a bunch of teams, reassigned people to various projects, but nothing really came out of it. And I'm struggling to think of like one really awesome project that came out of them doing all these acquisitions, doing all these mergers, all these buyouts, all these closures. I mean, I'm struggling to think of even one game that like was a direct result of them aggressively buying all these things. I just can't think of anything. I'm seriously drawing a blank. So if anybody out there listening to this podcast can think of some good that came out of all this recent action from Microsoft corporate lately, please let me know, because it seems like to me all that's happened was nothing good at all. So there you go. Slightly more positive news. Nintendo president of Nintendo Furukawa put out a message on Twitter recently, and it says here verbatim, "We will make an announcement about the successor to Nintendo Switch within this fiscal year. It will have been over 9 years since we announced the existence of Nintendo Switch back in March 2015. We will be holding a Nintendo Direct this June regarding the Nintendo Switch software lineup for the latter half of 2024. But please be aware, there will be no mention of the Nintendo Switch successor during that presentation." So, I mean, that's not bad. We're going to get some info fairly soon before the end of the fiscal year. And I think that ends in like July for most people, doesn't it? I'm not sure exactly how fiscal years go. That's always weird to me. But, you know, certainly before the end of the year. So we'll get some hard info. Just don't be too disappointed when that direct drops and there's no mention of it there. He's telling us straight up ahead of time, ain't nothing going to be there. So don't be mad when it's not there. So I respect that. Thank you for letting us know, Furukawa-san. And we will look forward to whatever information we get on the Nintendo Switch too. Let's see. Other random news. Microsoft is trying to launch a mobile game store to compete with the Android store and the iPhone. What is it? The Apple store. I think that they are getting mad that a lot of their profits are being taken by those competing storefronts. I don't know how they're going to pull this off, but it's in the works. I don't spend a lot of time on mobile, so I don't really know how important this is to them. I mean, it must be pretty important, otherwise I wouldn't probably try to do it. And frankly, I don't spend a lot of time on mobile in general. I mean, I play Marvel Snap and I play Marvel Puzzle Quest pretty regularly, but, you know, those are kind of my quote-unquote forever games on mobile. There's a lot of trash there that I don't spend time with. I just started playing Warhammer 40K Legions, and that was pretty good. But, you know, other than that, that's probably the only new mobile game I've started playing in the last couple of years. So I'm not really the person to ask about the mobile scene, but clearly it must be worth a couple of bucks to somebody. Otherwise, they wouldn't be trying to get this thing off the ground. So I guess keep your eyes out and see if that happens. I think there's probably a legal battle ahead of them. They're probably going to be fighting for percentages and profits from the people who already get them. So I guess we'll see what happens. Not a lot of faith in Microsoft right now, got to be honest with you, though. Circling back to Nintendo, they are the last people to get off the Twitter train. Twitter, which has always been my social media platform of choice, has been a shit show ever since raging fuckstain Elon Musk bought it and just like crashed into the ground. We can talk about that for a million years, but basically it's just been downward spiral ever since. And I don't know if he like jacked up the prices. I feel like he must have jacked up the prices for having like the API that lets consoles post directly to Twitter. Now, in the good days of Twitter, you could get on the Switch, you could get on your PS5, I think PS4 even as well. You could get on the Xbox X, the S, and I believe the 360, if I'm not mistaken. No, I'm sorry, not the 360. Well, that's too far. The Xbox One, I believe. Yeah, I think the One. I think the One had it. But regardless, you could do any of the modern consoles, Switch, Xbox, PlayStation. You could hook those up to Twitter easily, and then you could upload screenshots, you could upload video capture, you could comment on things, and like there was a lot of really awesome social media integration. I used it all the time. I loved, you know, something cool would happen, you'd pop an achievement, or you get like some wacky physics thing happen, you just like take a quick screenshot or a video, post it, and it was great because games were getting all this like extra, you know, viral PR. People just naturally sharing the content of their games. Natural advertising is like the best possible thing you can get for your game, and so it was very easy to do. I loved it, and also for purposes of GameCritics.com, I would have people who are writing for me, like play a game and then just post a picture to Twitter. I could grab it from Twitter real easily. Don't got to mess with like your little USB stick and all that stuff. It was just so painless and fun and simple. And then Elon Musk took over, fucked that guy for infinity. And it just got bad. I believe it cost something upwards of like $40,000 a month if they want to subscribe to the API. And both, God, who was it? I think Microsoft was the first person to say, fuck off. They left. And you just couldn't post anything anymore. Sony went a while ago, which was very disappointing to me because I still was posting a lot of screenshots from my PS5. And apparently now Nintendo is stopping. I don't know if it's already stopped, but if it's not stopped already, it will be stopped incredibly soon. Nintendo said, forget it. We're not paying your money anymore. And also, why should they? Because it's not the platform that it used to be, despite still being pretty crucial and pretty central to a lot of people's lives, myself included. Elon Musk is just ruining it, right? There's a lot of like gross stuff that didn't used to be there, or at least more gross stuff than used to be there. It's not being moderated properly. There's a lot more Nazis, a lot of like just disgusting bullshit, anti-trans stuff. So if I was a company, I'm not sure that I would want to be associated with Twitter anyway. So I don't blame them for leaving, but for the sake of just like utility, for connection, for community, you know, it was just a really great way to connect on games and to share that stuff. So I guess nothing's going to be able to post to Twitter anymore. And I feel like that's kind of the end of an era. So that makes me a little bit sad. All right. A couple of questions from people listening, which I'm always super appreciative and grateful for. And then we'll get on to the main portion of the show here. First one comes from Grabloid, a good friend from the Gaming in the Wild Discord. If you haven't gone over to the Gaming in the Wild Discord, I think it's one of my favorite places to hang out online. And also, the show is fantastic, so give it a listen. I'm sure you probably already do. But if you don't, Gaming in the Wild, run by good friend John, is amazing, and his community is great. Grabloid says, 2D gaming or 3D gaming? What is better? If you could only have one, which one are you taking? Man, that is a tough question. That's like asking me to choose between my children. And I guess I'm going to have to. I guess I will. So, I think there's bonuses and good things to both. I think there's also downsides to both. I mean, I don't really necessarily see that one is inherently better than the other. I think they each have their strengths. They each have their appeal. They each have their styles, which appeal to me. But I got to be honest. I agonized over this for a little while before I came up with my answer. And I think if I had to choose one, I think I would probably choose 2D gaming, because number one, I'm a big fan of pixel art and that lends itself naturally to the 2D space. I am a fan of turn-based games, and that's not to say you can't do that in 3D space, but there's a lot of 2D turn-based games, which I really like. I like also the generally smaller scale of some of these games. I think that more concise worlds, you know, less cruft, less bloat, and something that's smaller, focused. A lot of indies tend to do 2D games, which I think is good. I like a lot of indie games as well. So I think if I had to choose one, I probably would choose 2D, but that's not to say that I don't like 3D. I mean, I like them both. I mean, I can probably name 20 games of either way, you know, 2D or 3D that I would really think are just banging on timers. So, you know, if I had to imagine myself like on a desert island or something like that, I think if I really looked into my deepest heart of hearts, I think I would choose 2D. Maybe part of that is because I'm just an older gamer and it was like what I grew up with. I have a lot of fond memories of that, but I still do play a lot of 2D games these days. I mean, that hasn't really changed. Most of my Switch stuff that I play is 2D. I don't play a lot of 3D stuff on the Switch, and I play the Switch like basically every day. So, yeah, I'm going to have to go with 2D, but you know, that's not to say that I don't like 3D. I mean, I could have easily chosen 3D and I would have made a good case for that as well. But I think maybe just the pixel art and the genres that tend to be on 2D are my favorite type of genres. Roguelikes, like action-y platformers, turn-based strategy. You know, you can find examples in either medium, but I think they are pretty strong in 2D, and I think I probably would go with that. So, you made me cry. You made me agonize. I tore my hair out. I thought about it. at all hours. I was up all night. I thought about it for a long time. Grabloid, you were really tearing me apart here, buddy. But it's going to be 2D. So there you go. Next question comes from Elijah, writer at Game Critics and also a member of the So Video Games Discord community, which is also a great little community. Small but growing, and you are also always welcome to join us over there if you like. But he sent in some questions. He sent me a bunch of like a huge list of questions beforehand and said that I could pepper these in as I wanted to. So I've got one from him here. He says, what happened to the other 61 Nintendos between the SNES and the N64? Simple. Those were Japan only. I thought you knew that. I thought everybody knew that. That's pretty common knowledge. So the N1 all the way through the N63. Yeah, you can import those. They were pretty cool. I have three or four of them in a row. Not directly in a row. I think I like, you know, have the N1, then maybe the N5. Waited for the N15. The N32 was pretty good. You know, they're out there. You can find them. Just hit eBay. Look them up. You'll find them. Surprised you didn't know that, Elijah. I'm surprised. I thought you knew that. I'm a little shocked. Final question comes from John, who I just spoke about a minute ago. He of Gaming in the Wild, he of Reykjavik. And this is funny because he actually gave me this question in the Discord for the show, and like a dum-dum, I answered him in his Discord. I think I was not fully awake, and I was like, oh, well, someone's asking me a question. I'll just answer it right now. Yeah, dumb. But I'll read it here anyway. I answered him there. I'll read it here anyway for people who are not in that Discord. But you should be. So, okay. John's question was, did you pick up any of the May 9th Indiegeddon games? That was a crazy day of releases. Animal Well, Little Kitty Big City, 1000 Times Resist, Cryptmaster, and Crow Country, and I think there's probably a couple others. Did I get any of those? Well, you know, I do love indie games. I really do, although after answering this question, I think that people will doubt me. But I think, despite the fact that all of those are very anticipated, and from what I hear so far from people that I trust, every single one of those has been pretty well received. But they just weren't exactly to my taste. So, for example, Little Kitty Big City, I'm not a fan of cats. I actually don't like cats, and if you think that makes me a bad person, I guess I can't change your mind, but I'm just not a cat fan, and I just don't have a lot of cat appeal. So I may dip into it. I think it's on Game Pass, but it's not anything that's really high up on my list, and you know, if you're not much of a cat person, I guess there's not as much pull as there might be if you were a cat person. Cryptmaster is kind of a dungeon crawl with a text parser. Now, that does look kind of up my alley, but you guys know I don't play a lot of PC. Very rarely will I play stuff on PC. That's changing a little bit lately, especially since I'm doing the show on my own these days. But I just don't want to play stuff on PC. So as fun as that looks, I'm just going to give that a pass because I just know I just won't play it. Because the best place for me to play PC is in my office, and it's also in my studio, my recording space here. And when I'm not doing work, I don't really want to be in here. I want to be up on my couch, on my comfortable chair, hanging out with the fam. PC gaming just isn't a thing for me in my life right now. So I'm going to give that one a pass. Crow Country, which is winning a lot of fans right now, looks kind of like a cutesy, I don't know, PS1 era Resident Evil-ish throwback. And I'm just not that big on survival horror these days. I play it occasionally. I haven't like stopped playing those games, but they're not my favorite. And I've never been a fan of like the whole like key thing that Resident Evil does, where you get like half a chess piece and another half a chess piece, then you put it together, then you put it in a chess shaped hole, and then a gem comes out, and you get that gem, you put it in a statue, and the statue uses a laser, then the laser melts an ice wall, and inside is like a dead body, and you get something out of the dead body, and then it's like another key, and then it's like a password, and blah 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 blah. I'm not a fan of that, and I don't like running back and forth and going back to the item box and stuff. People say it's really well done, and I believe them, but any kind of like Resident Evil inspired thing is not really going to connect with me. And to be perfectly frank, I'm not a big fan of the retro PS1 graphics. I loved the PS1 when it came out. I have many, many, many fond memories of the PS1. I have lots of the games still. It was a wonderful time to be playing games, but I don't want to go back to it. I don't have that kind of nostalgia where I want to be looking at those graphics again, even if they're kind of touched up for modern times. So Crow Country was not going to be something that was pretty high on my list. Although I hear it's great. Animal Well looks fun, but that looks to me like, and I may be wrong, but it seems to me like one of those really smarty smart pants indie games where you've got to connect the dots with a lot of deep mysteries and secrets to find, and you know, oh, there's a little bit of lore over here, and there's an item over here, and you do this thing over here, and you put these two concepts together and figure it out, and this goes over here. And I'm just not that guy. I just don't like finding secrets. I don't like humping the walls to find secret passageways. I don't like, you know, putting the dots together because I'm tired, man. I'm tired. I work a lot. I got a family. I got a lot of things on my plate. I don't have spare brain power or spare energy to try to figure out puzzles that somebody who's probably a lot smarter than me put together in this game. And I just can't, man. I just don't want to. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe it goes on sale. Maybe if people rave about it. But this kind of reminds me a little bit of like Fez or The Witness or any of those recent games where you can play it, but also you got to be pretty smart to figure out all the real stuff going on. And I'm just not that dude anymore. I'm just tired. I'm just real tired, man. And the last one, 1,000 Times Resist. Now, that one did seem to be in my wheelhouse. This is one where it's kind of like, I think it's like a time travel story, sort of. There's like androids and some kind of plague where people are crying and all sorts of weird stuff. Now, that does seem to be my jam. But for some reason, the publisher, Fellow Traveler, who Game Critics has had a really good relationship with, just didn't send us any PR on it. I didn't get an offer for a review code, and I saw a lot of people talking about it here and there. And honestly, I heard most about it from John over his show, Gaming in the Wild. He talked about it a couple times. And so that was really what put it on my radar. So thank you for that, John. So I reached out to Fellow Traveler to see if there was a review opportunity or coverage opportunity. I haven't heard back from him yet, but it was just weird. Like we usually get 30, 40 different PR emails a day, but that was one that never came through. And I even went back to my Google archive to see if maybe I just missed it. Maybe I was tired. Maybe I archived it on accident or something. And no, I didn't get any PR on it. So I don't know what happened. Apparently they went to a new PR company for this one. So I don't know. Maybe we're not on their list or what. Did they drop the ball? Who knows what? I don't know. But I'll see if I can get my hands on it. If I do, I'll certainly report back. But out of all the Indiegeten games, that was the one that had my most of my focus, my most attention. So we'll see if I can make that happen. But if not, I will be content to hear other people talk about it because honest to gosh, I've just got so much to play right now. I've got more to play than I've got time to play, and it's just adding every day. So you can't play them all, folks. You cannot play them all. So, all right, folks, that was housekeeping. Thanks to everybody. Grabloid, Elijah, John, thank you for those questions. And what else do we have here? Before I get to the main portion of the show, just want to remind folks that you can help support this very podcast, this one you're listening to right now. How do you do that? By going to patreon.com/thesovideogamespodcast. Every little bit helps with the cost of hosting and such. And that cost is going up every month. That blows. Also, huge thanks to all of our Patreon supporters who are already putting their money where their ears are. I really, really do appreciate it. Also, want to give a big shout out to people who retweet and share the show. If you do, we really do, really, 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 really do appreciate it. But I want to give special thanks to folks who basically retweet everyone and share it and just really help get that word out there. I really appreciate it. Sentinot Plus, J Monster, Mike Burnett, Steve Morton, and of course, the hero of all time, Adderblack39. Thank you all very much. Every share. So again, super grateful to everyone who helps keep the show going. But rest assured, whether you contribute to the Patreon or not, no content will ever be paywalled. You'll get the same great show free of charge every week. Also, the Discord, which I mentioned earlier, the Soviet Games Discord, anyone is free to join. If you want to join up, just let me know. We can continue this conversation after the show. Just shoot me an email and I will send you all the details. Okay, I think that is it. Now we are going to get to the main portion of the show. All right, the new tradition, I think, starting off the main portion is going to be the Circlebacks real quick. Those are games that I am still playing. We've covered before in greater detail, but I'm going to just touch on them really quickly to let you know that I'm still playing and to keep these on your radar. Number one, Sandland. Still going through this. Having just banger of a time with it. Still watching the show. Still playing the RPG. It's just been great. At this point, I made quite a bit of progress, and I have, I think, 4 out of 5 vehicles. I've got the tank. I've got the motorcycle. I've got the car. And I've got the jumping robot. Gosh, you know, there might be more than that even. I'm not sure. Maybe there's 6? Who knows? But I'm still having a blast. Just going through the stories, progressing at a great clip. There's really no fat on these bones whatsoever. Exploring the land, fighting enemies. It's just a really, really good time. I'm just having a lot of fun with that one. So definite thumbs up, and I'll circle back again, I'm sure. Also, want to touch back on Classified France 44, which has become one of my favorite turn-based tactics games of the year. I put the campaign on hold, and I was like 3/4 of the way through because of review responsibilities and such, but I came back to it, and it's just as good as I remember. It still is keeping my attention. I'm doing like one mission a night, and I should be done with it pretty soon, but taking the Allies into France and kind of like helping the resistance and pushing the Nazis back never fails to feel good. They also released a bunch of DLC for it, which I didn't realize between the time that I put it on hold and now. I think there was like 3 or 4 DLC packs coming out, and I think there's one more coming where they each have new equipment, like the clothes, which has armor and different effects, new weapons, and I believe they each have at least one new mission and a couple new story sequences. So I haven't gotten to the new content yet. I'm not sure exactly how you access it, but I did download some of those, paid for those out of my own pocket, and I am slowly getting to the final conflict of that game, which is D-Day. So we'll check it out, but it's still great stuff. If you want some turn-based action, that one is definitely a winner for sure. All right, first brand new game of the show is Insurmountable. This is one I've been looking forward to ever since I first saw it, at least a year ago, if not more. This is a roguelike. It's a 3D game, although it could almost be a board game, basically. It's a game where you play a person who is climbing a steep mountain. And so the mountain is broken up into hexes. You start off at the foothills, and then you go hex by hex up the mountain. There's varied levels of terrain. There's like, you know, rocky terrain, solid terrain. There's some icy terrain, slippery terrain, stuff like that. And so you have to kind of plan your ascent up the mountain. The goal, ostensibly, is to get to the summit. And I will say, when you start the game and you are at the bottom and you look up, I'm just like, wow, I'm never going to get to that summit. It seems a jillion miles away. It's so tall. That's so imposing. It must be what it feels like when a mountain climber gets to like the base of some really famous peak. So it's turn-based. There's no real-time action, but you start the game with like a sanity meter, a heat meter, energy meter, and one other thing. Maybe it's like a food meter. You have 4 meters. I forget what the fourth one is. But of course, you have to like watch all your meters. And then as you go up the mountains, hex by hex, you can plan your route. You can, you know, you can pick a distance point, and then the AI will plot it for you, or you can choose hex by hex, or you can do a mix of both. So whichever way you want to go up the mountain, you can kind of like choose your own path. As you look up the mountain, you will see little icons, and so there will be an icon that says you're going to have an encounter with another hiker here, or there is an item to pick up over here, or there is a cave to sleep at over here, or there's a surprise event over here. So you can kind of see what's what. They tell you what type of event they are, so you can kind of guide yourself as you go. If you're good on supplies and you don't need anything, maybe you can skip that treasure chest and just keep going up the mountain to get it more quickly. If you're interested in the lore and the happenings of the game, maybe you want to like aim yourself more towards the encounters with other people and see what they're about. And so there's all sorts of little, like, you know, random events that pop up. Sometimes, for example, in one of the treasure chest events, I got to one and it was like, oh, there's a backpack stuck on a branch and it's dangling over the cliff. Do you try to reach for it? Yes or no? And I'm like, yes. And like, it took a big chunk of my energy out because I was really struggling to get the backpack and I didn't get it. And it's like, you didn't get it, but you're getting kind of tired. Do you still want to go for it? And I'm like, well, sure, I guess. And then I did go for it and I got it. And it ended up being like a can of food or something. So it was like, okay, but was it really worth the energy that I expended? I don't know. You know, other types of events crop up. Like maybe you come across a cave and you want to know, should you explore it, leave it alone? Maybe you meet somebody who is wandering. They want to trade with you. Should you trade with them? Yes or no? Will they be friendly? Yes or no? So there's all sorts of little events that pop up, which I think is neat. And I think that's good. But I have to say that overall, I would be lying if I said I wasn't just a wee bit disappointed with this one. I think part of it is that, okay, so there's twofold. Part of it is the content and part of it is like the production. Let's talk about production first. So in Insurmountable, I'm playing it on Xbox X, and I have a big TV. I have like a 60-inch TV. Now, I don't know if that's big to people. To me, that feels like an enormous TV. I've usually always had TVs that were much smaller than that, and I upgraded because I got a really good deal on it. And I figured, why not? Splurge, right? But 60-inch to me feels like fucking... It's almost like I'm looking at a movie screen, right? Maybe other people think that's not big or whatever. But, you know, for me, it's huge. Very large. And the text in this game is microscopic. On my 60-inch screen, and I'm only sitting maybe about 5 feet from it, it's almost impossible to read. And my eyes are fine. And so they really needed to, like, upscale that text by, like, a huge margin. There's a picture of your hiker, which ends up being like really low res, and it just looks kind of cheap. Looks like they didn't do their proper porting to make it look nice. I had a lot of problems with the camera. The camera feels extremely whack to me, where You can't just have a free look camera. This game is like screaming out for a free look camera. I don't know if they intend the inability to see what's coming to be part of the gameplay. I mean, I guess it's possible, but for me, and not to be like, you know, I don't know, backseat game developer, but I will be for a second. If that was what you were going after, like if you didn't want people to know what was coming, maybe a similar effect, like a fog of war effect, might have been a little bit better. Maybe let people look around, have a free look camera, but then fog of war everything. So maybe something's a dead end. Maybe something is going to be slippery later on. Maybe there's an item that you don't know is there or not. Like, I get it, right? Like when you're a mountain climber in real life, not that I am, but I'm assuming, you probably don't know the one good way to get the mountain. You're probably exploring. You're looking for paths. You're looking for handholds. I get it. That makes sense. And that seems like a good game mechanic here. But the way that it is just doesn't work because you just cannot move the friggin' camera the way that you want it to. I'm constantly struggling to be like, wait, is this a path? Is it not? I can't quite tell. You can zoom in and zoom out, but that's not good enough. You can turn the camera, but again, not good enough. It's really hard to see where you're going. And then you can also do a look around button, which pins the camera in place, and then you can kind of pivot from there. But it's not as good as having a free look camera that's been in like a million other games. Like, it's, I don't know why they didn't do it. Maybe they are having production problems. They didn't have anything behind the mountain. They didn't want you to see the end of the skybox or something. I don't know what's going on, but like the camera sucks in this game. It's really bad and it's really harshing my mellow because I'm often struggling with just like trying to pivot the camera to make it look where I want it to look. And I feel like it's inhibiting my choices when I'm playing the game. I just feel like I can't quite get a good look around, and it doesn't feel intentional to me. It just feels like a really bad camera. I don't know if it was that bad on PC, but it's really, really bad here. There's also this one option where your mountain climber moves really slowly. And I remember when I started the run, they were like, would you like your climber to have fast speed? It's cosmetic. And I'm like, well, no, let me have the good experience first, the basic vanilla. And I did. And I'm like, oh, snap, they walk way too slow. And now I'm to the point where I just want the hiker to go to just get through the choices quickly. And I can't find that choice anymore. I think maybe you can only choose it when you start the game, which is really silly. I feel like that should be an option you can turn on and off. So I feel like there's a lot of production, I don't want to say problems, but just like places that just don't feel as good as they need to feel. Like they don't feel polished. They don't feel smooth. They don't feel intuitive. I feel like I'm struggling with just like the interface half the time, squinting to read the text and trying to pivot the camera. It just does not feel very good. Now, in terms of content, I think the game is interesting, but it feels very detached. It feels very remote. When I'm playing this game, I love the idea of going hex by hex up a mountain. I mean, I've been like on board with this idea since I saw our quick teaser trailer like a year ago or some screenshots a year ago. I'm like, yes, this looks great. I love roguelikes. I love different roguelikes. I love this kind of concept. But it just feels very like sedate. Like there's no animation that happens for any of the events. You're not getting any spoken dialogue. It feels like it's just very like menu driven and kind of cold and dry. And I really want to have like just a little bit more spice, a little bit of excitement. Like when there's an avalanche, I want to see an avalanche. When you encounter the Bigfoot, there should be one that walks across the screen. When you're meeting people, it would be cool if there was like a little bit more of a personal interface. It just feels very, very dry and very, just very detached. I feel very distant from the action. I don't feel super involved in climbing the mountain. It feels like what I'm mostly doing is just watching the meters. And meter watching is fine. It's a vital part of certain games and certainly of roguelikes, but it just feels like I'm just mostly watching the meters right now. And like a lot of this doesn't really connect with me. I don't really feel like I'm on the mountain. I don't really feel the tension of walking across an icy surface or of scaling rocks that might give way beneath my hands. It just feels like which path is going to eat my meters away less and then do that and then do my best. Also, just as a thing that really kind of bugs me, when you have a tent in this game, if you sleep out uncovered, it really has a bad effect on you. And so you want to sleep in a cave. Caves are too few and far between. And then sometimes you hit a bunch. It's probably randomly distributed. But I feel like, wow, it's really hard to find a cave when I need one. Also, tents that you have, which serve like a cave, can only be used 3 times, which is silly to me because I've had a tent for a while and I can use it way more than 3 times. And it seems like I should be able to use it more than 3 times, which is odd. But also the thing that really bugs me the most is when you're in a tent or when you're in a cave and you're sleeping, you can choose short sleep or long sleep, which is fine. But if it's cold and dark, I don't want to be walking around in the dark. And so I want to just sleep until morning. that's not an option. Like, it counts hours from when you start sleeping. And so there's been plenty of times when I start sleeping, I wake up, still dark. And if it was me in real life on the mountain, I'd be like, well, I'm staying in my tent. I'll just make some hot cocoa. I'll read a book, or I'll, you know, chill on my phone until the sun is up, and then I'll start climbing again. And you can't. It's just little stuff like that just really kind of bugs me. I'm like, why did you make that choice? Like, it just doesn't seem very sensible. It doesn't seem very logical. It just seems like, I don't know, a little bit too tied to the systems. I wish they leaned into the drama of climbing a mountain a little bit more rather than being so systems driven. But it's okay. I scaled the mountain. I'm not going to spoil it, but something happens after that. So the game is not over at that point, which I thought was pleasantly surprised. I am still chipping away at it, but it just feels so dry. I just wish it was, I just wish I was feeling more of that drama, but I'm not. So anyway, that is Insurmountable, playing it on Xbox right now. All right, we're going to continue the Xbox coverage here with Vampire Survivors, not just the base game, but the new DLC, which just dropped a couple of days ago at the time I'm recording. Operation Guns sells for $250, I believe. It is a DLC to the ongoing success story that is Vampire Survivors. Man, what a game. What a game. If you haven't played Vampire Survivors by now, where you been? You got to at least check it out. I love Vampire Survivors. It was one of my games of the year that dropped, and I've been playing it off and on ever since. It's real easy to dip in and dip out and just get a couple minutes in and feel like you did something. There's like so many unlocks and so many little micro goals you can go for that it just feels like a really worthwhile use of your time every time you get in there. And even if you don't unlock anything, just playing that game, it just gets me in the space, and I just feel like my hands move enough and my brain is engaged enough and I don't have to remember any lore. Just playing it, just the simple act of play is just really pleasant to me. They've had, I believe, at least 3 DLCs before this one. This might be the 4th, if I recall properly. I think there were 2 unique DLCs, unique that were created by the developer, Ponkle. They had one that was based on Among Us, which is really funny. And now this one is based on Contra, the game, the storied 2D action shooter from a long time ago in the 80s. You know, one of the granddaddies of the 2D shoot 'em up. Contra, man, I mean, I was surprised to see this because Contra hasn't really been in the news for a while. I think there's some kind of a sequel coming, or maybe just dropped. But even still, it feels like Contra is like a really strange and unexpected. I mean, welcome. Absolutely welcome, because Contra is awesome. But strange that it popped up. Apparently, the developer at Ponkle was a big fan of Konami's early work, as were we all if you were old enough to play it back then. And Contra was just one of the seminal, just like huge, like everybody played it on the NES back then. Like everybody, it was just like, you know, everybody knew what Contra was. Everybody had experience with it. You know, the up, up, down, down, left, right, BA code was key to playing that game. I mean, that's really how it got big. So Operation Guns is all about Contra. You have, it integrates with the main DLC in Vampire Survivors already. And if you don't know how this works, here's how it works. So Vampire Survivors, the 2D Survivors-like, I don't even know how to describe it. I'm not going to call it a bullet heaven. I'm not going to call it a bullet hell. I don't even know how to say it. It's just a Vampire Survivors game where you have your character. They auto-shoot, auto-fire on their own, and you just got to guide them around the screen, gathering power-ups as you go. So how the other DLC works is there's a list of unlocks, and you have to unlock a certain number of things to get the new content. And then when you get the new content, you unlock some stuff with the new content, get the even newer content. And that's basically true here. So you get the Operation Guns DLC. It gives you a new stage called Neo Galuga. And it's built to look like a Contra stage. It's pretty cool. I wish it was a little bit bigger. But how it starts off is you're on the left side and you're kind of like in this like, I don't know, just a regular area. You kind of go through like a city, and then you go through like a bridge, and then you kind of keep going. And then there's like the alien spawn part where like alien grossness is all over the place. Very much, it feels like you were walking left to right in a traditional Contra sense, which was awesome. Like a really cool nod. I wish it went on longer, but it's still, for what it is, I think it's fucking awesome. I got the gist immediately, as I was a person who played Contra back in the day. So I'm like, okay, I get it. I get redoing. You're in the city, ruins, cyborgs, thing get more organic as you go. Cross the bridge, there's a lot of water, get to the like the gross city, like okay, like it's just like all the nostalgia, all the feels coming back. It was great. I had to use one of the other random non-Contra characters to unlock the Contra character, but then I got, I think it was Bill Reiser, the first one, and he's got this gun and he looks just like he's straight out of a Contra game. He's got his blue pants, his headband, big fucking rifle, and it's fucking fun. His gun is really fun to use. It operates a little bit like the knife in that it goes where you point. One of the very few weapons in this game that actually goes where you point it to. So that was really fun. They've got some Contra music playing in the background. They've got Contra sound effects, like when you do like some of the weapons, some of the shooting sounds like Contra shooting, if you remember what that sounds like back in the day. They've got little capsules. If you ever played Contra, there's little oblong capsules with word with letters on them that fly, and you get them, and it changes how your gun shoots, which is great. Getting the flamethrower or the double beam or something is like fucking awesome. It works. Like, it really, really works. It's really fun. The power up for his gun is like two little drones that add to his firepower. And then once you play with Bill and unlock some more stuff, I played two games, and I think I unlocked 15 different things, which was a really great run, or two runs. And I unlocked like Lance, the other one, and I unlocked like some of the other, like a couple alien guys you could be. I think there was a robot, some other, like another stage, a second Contra stage, which I'm looking forward to. So it's just really fucking great. I love Vampire Survivors. It's so fun to play. I love Contra from back in the day. I think this is a natural fit. It feels good. It's fun to play this. I think it integrates well with the Vampire Survivors core. And that's kind of what's so magical about this game, right? You can just jump in, play anytime. You could plug like basically anything into this and it would work. It's almost like the Fortnite of Vampire Survivors likes, where you can put any character here and you're like, yep, this goes, this works, this makes sense. So absolutely a huge thumbs up. Now, to give you a rundown, I looked it up before the show. If you buy the 250 DLC Operation Guns, you get 11 characters, although the developer said there's actually 12. One is a secret. So 12 characters, 22 new weapons, that's including fusions and upgrades, one huge stage and one bonus stage, 30 in-game unlocks, a 6-chapter adventure, which I'm a little bit unclear about. I'm not sure how you get the adventure unlocked. I got to look that up. And the feeling of being a badass president's cousin, sister's dog saver, which is, I mean, says it all right there. So huge thumbs up. This is the good shit. It's a great reason to go back to Vampire Survivors. I'm having a blast with it. I don't know that I'll unlock everything, but I'm definitely going to unlock a few more things. I'm going to give Lance a go, play some of the alien characters, see what other weird weapons they unlock. This game's just fun as shit, dude. Just fun. Just pure fucking fun. I love Vampire Survivors, so very happy to see that it's still going strong. New DLC, looking forward to what they do next. This is absolutely huge, huge, huge thumbs up. All right, next game is actually a pair of games. This is kind of a funny story. The first one is The Foretold Exordium, and the next one is The Foretold Westmark Legacy. Now, I said earlier that I don't play a lot of PC games. It takes a lot for me to get on PC and play a game, but this is one of the games that made me do it. Full disclosure, I did kickstart this game a while ago. I was very excited to give it a shot. And now that I think about it, I don't think I ever got my Kickstarter rewards. Or maybe I did and I forgot. I don't know, but I got a code from the developer and publisher for this one, so thank you very much for that. I got one for the Vampire Survivor stuff too as well, by the way. So The Foretold is a roguelike deck builder, I guess, ish, that has an interesting kind of mechanic, and it's set in a Cthulhu-like universe. So already you know why I'm in. I like deck builders, I like roguelikes, I like Cthulhu stuff, Lovecraft stuff. I'm definitely in the basket for all that stuff. So the funny thing is, when they sent me the code, PR sent me the code, they sent me the code for Exordium, which was actually like kind of a pre-release sampler demo thing, and I'm like, oh, this is the wrong code, but okay, fine, I'll play it anyway. And I played that, and it's essentially the same thing as the main game, so it's not even really worth talking about, but it's available there if you want to play it, if you want a little bit of a story content or whatever. But you can just jump right into the main thing. I think it's fine. The main game is The Foretold Westmark Legacy. Basically, you play as this character who, I don't know what his backstory is, but he's got a ghost with him. Apparently he did like some kind of a summoning or something that went wrong, and the ghost ended up being bonded to him. So it's him, normal human guy, plus he's got this like spirit friend who kind of hangs out with him. And then some kind of bad shit's going down. He gets summoned to this town and he needs to go figure out what's going on. So it's like, you know, he's got a cloak, they're riding a carriage, there's like kind of weird Cthulhu stuff happening. Like, it looks cool. And honestly, I really like the art a lot. It's kind of this weird, kind of like off-putting, off-kilter art style, which I think works really, really well. I like it a lot. I think it's a perfect match for Lovecraftian Cthulhu stuff. It looks very much in the pocket. It looks like you'd want it to look. So I like the art a lot. And I do like deck builders. So I was curious as to how this was going to play. So unfortunately, I don't think that I really care for how it plays. And it's weird because you would think it's a deck builder and it kind of looks like one at first. But once you start playing, you're like, okay, this isn't quite a deck builder. So what it is math, I guess. I don't know. I'm not sure how to describe it. Basically, when you're on a like a map, like many roguelikes do these days, where you have these little nodes, you can go along these nodes, choose, like one might have an item, one might have a story event, one might be a combat. You kind of pick and choose as you go. You can rest at one, et cetera, et cetera. If you've played like Slay the Spire or any of the games that have come since then, that pretty much set the template for what everybody's done since then. And for good reason, it works. And so it's kind of like that sort of a map. You go down this map, you get items, you collect things, then you get to an encounter. And the encounter is when you start doing the combat. So I was honestly very confused by this for like a while. But basically, you have your guy on the left side, enemy on the right side. It could be like a diseased fisherman or a giant rat or whatever, some kind of monster or something, like a variety of like what you would expect from like a Lovecraft type game. In the middle of the screen, though, is what I didn't expect. And it looks like a bunch of... Oh, man, I'm struggling to explain this. I'm sorry. It looks like a bunch of, like, I don't know, like rocks that are falling in a couple of different channels. There's like four different channels. And then at the bottom are your cards. And so what happens is there are numeric sums at the bottom of these channels. And then you need to get the rocks. Each rock has a number on it. And you want to get the number of rocks falling into these channels to match the number that the channel has. So for example, let's say that you got the leftmost channel has the number 4, and you look at the chute that leads into the channel, and there's a rock that has the number 3. Okay, no problem. So you let that rock fall. It's got 3 out of 4. Now your next job will be to look for a rock that has the number 1 and get that rock into that same channel. If you get it in that channel, then it adds up to 4 and the channel locks, and then that does something. So how you get these rocks to move, that's where your cards come in, because the cards have like hands on them. It'll say move left, move right, skip a turn, or add the sum, or skip one, or divide by 2, or something like that. So that's what your cards do. You're not even really like attacking the person that you're fighting against. You're manipulating the cards to make the rocks fall into their chutes to make sure that the numbers add up to the right number. And then that does something. Now, you've heard me say twice now that does something, because honestly, I don't know what it does. And honestly, I don't understand the system, because, for example, when you start this rock business, it'll say, oh, you've got 3 turns left. And I'm like, okay, so that means in my head, I've got 3 turns left to get these sums the right way, and then something's going to happen. But it doesn't work like that. Sometimes you make one rock drop and then the whole thing kicks off, and then like you do like an exchange. And I'm like, well, I thought I had 2 turns left. You said I had 3 turns. I only took 1 turn. What happened to the other 2 turns? And then you come back to it, you do another one, and sometimes it goes a couple times, sometimes it goes 1 time. I don't understand how the turns count. It doesn't make sense to me. If there's some indication, then I'm not aware of it. I'm also a little bit hazy on how you're attacking. I guess you eventually have to like equip stuff. I think I had like a knife. I think I also had like a lighter or something like that. Like you equip it as like a piece of equipment on your item screen, but then somehow that connects to the channels that are on the screen. And so if you get a couple of those channels locked by having the rocks drop into them and add the right number, then that means something to the item, and then the item somehow attacks sometimes. I don't know. I don't get it. I just don't get it. This is not clear to me. I understand the rocks thing. I understand the locking of the channels thing when the rocks fall into the channels, but like, I don't understand the turn taking. I don't understand how the attacking's happening. A lot of this game is really vague and just non-specified to me, and I just don't get it. I looked up some advice online, and some people really get this game. Like, clearly some people understand it more than I do, but for me, I was like a little bit lost. It just felt very murky and non-specific, and some people said they finished it no problem and all this other stuff, and so I guess it works for some people, but it did not work for me. I had a very mystifying and unsatisfying experience with this, and I just didn't like feeling like I didn't quite know what was going on. Like, I've played games before. I have played a couple games before. And I feel like this was kind of a falling down of the tutorialization and also of the UI. I just think that some things need to be surfaced a lot more clear and cleanly. You know, if you look at something like Slay the Spire or other similar games, like, the best roguelikes surface everything. They make sure that you know exactly what's happening and why it's happening. Because that's really important. You got to make your strategic decisions. And if you don't know what's happening, it's hard to decide. And then you can't make the right choices and things go sideways. And it's just kind of frustrating, right? So I've played a million roguelikes. I'm Mr. Roguelike. I've played a million deck builders. I am basically Mr. Deck Builder. But I just didn't understand or appreciate the way this one came through together. And I just was... Just left me feeling very unsatisfied. I'm sure there's a rhyme and reason to it all. I'm sure there's a logic there. But with my two sessions that I sat down with it, I just felt kind of frustrated and mystified by it, and I wasn't having a very good time. So I'm going to give these ones a pass. But like I said, I did kickstart it, so I hope that they enjoyed my contribution. I hope they had success. But this one is not for me. Okay, now those were all the games that I covered myself personally this week, and I'm still trying to find a new path for So Video Games. Again, not going anywhere. We're still going to do the podcast every week. That's a thing that's locked in. But I'm still trying to find a new like format, right? And so I can only play so many games myself per week. You know, I used to bring at least three or four. Carlos used to bring three or four. And so I can't make up that gulf just on my own. So I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, you know, maybe what I can do is, since I am also the editor of GameCritics.com, maybe I would like read out one of the reviews we ran during the week. So number one, it would kind of give you a sense of what kind of reviews we're running over there. And also maybe it would tempt you to go and click over and check it out. There's also tons more reviews. We've got several thousand reviews in the archive over there. So I'm going to read this one now, just like out loud, like audiobook style. And let me know what you think. I don't know if this is like a good idea, bad idea. I'm just going to try this out. I want your feedback on it. Would you like me to read out one review per week from GameCritics.com? Is it boring? Is it exciting? Do you not care? Let me know what you think. I'm going to just give this a try and we'll just see how this goes. And I really want to hear what you think. So the review I'm going to read this week is Tales of Kenzera Zao. This is the main review, written by Patricio Do Rosario, who has been writing for us for a while now. This is the 2D Afrofuturistic action platformer that came out recently, and he's got some stuff to say about it. So let me click on over here. All right. His tagline is, "It's a breath of fresh air in every sense." At Game Critics, before every review, we do a high, low, and a what the fuck. His high is that it has full Swahili voiceovers. The low is that it's a break in rhythm after pausing the game. There was a mechanical thing that came up. And the WTF, the what the fuck, is, again, everyone is speaking Swahili. So this is Patricio's review. I will read it right now. Africa is not a setting oft used in the gaming industry, especially not in AA or AAA spaces. So to see a title that not only features the continent and its biomes, but its culture and language so prominently was a jarring yet welcome experience. Tales of Kenzera Zao follows a young shaman named Zao attempting to bring his father back to life by making a deal with Kalunga, the god of death. The irony is strong right from the jump in this one. Before anything else, take a moment and try to recall the last time an Afrocentric title such as this one came out. What about the last time we saw a game fully voiced with an African language from start to finish? You can't, and neither can I. That alone counts hugely in Zao's favor. In terms of narrative, themes of grief have been explored ad nauseum in gaming, but Zao adds a few African twists that are true to form in terms of how grief is viewed and enacted. Ancestral veneration, for example, is a central focus. While the West and Japan tend to mourn the passing of loved ones, African cultures see grief as a way to maintain connection and an honoring of those who have passed. Zao, unfortunately, took the maintaining contact bit a little too literally, though. Symbiosis with nature and spirituality is another heavy theme explored in Zao, and it's done with care, as can be seen with the first boss. Where it would be unsurprising to see developers just go with a generic elemental wind theme, without spoilers, I can say they instead went for a more maternal human angle, which makes the story more believable, and the tragic ending to this mini-arc only adds authenticity to the hard task that a shaman might face. Mechanically, Tales of Kenzera Zao is a 2D Metroidvania side-scroller. Traversal is exactly what one has come to expect from the genre in recent years, with lots of precise double jumping and dashing required to progress past challenging platform arrays. In fact, the traversal is so pleasantly precise that it leads to a fluid gameplay loop where the only failures come from the player's own mistakes. One of my favorites was a challenging puzzle that included the freezing of water. Zao had to run on it while also timing the melting point to allow him to dash to the next section before being washed away by a strong current. Besides challenging platforming, there's also a healthy dose of combat that offers two aspects, abilities based on the sun and moon. The moon is comprised largely of ranged attacks, and the sun focuses on close quarters combat and melee. Enemies are weak to one or the other, but never both, forcing the player to switch rapidly back and forth between aspects. These fights can sometimes be considered puzzles, as the player has to keep track of not just one opponent at a time, but often several enemies at once, who are not all weak to the same aspect simultaneously. In later levels, some enemies even have regenerating shields that allow them to fully absorb all damage if the player uses the wrong shaman power. The combat skill tree is less expansive than many players might be accustomed to, but there is such a thing as too much choice when it comes to leveling up abilities in modern gaming, and Zhao's streamlined upgrades help to maintain focus and progression. Plus, it's important to note that most of the powerful abilities are gained as the story progresses. Things like the aforementioned ability to freeze water, or being able to throw a powerful spiritual spear that does extra damage. Also, on the plus side for me, was a lack of collectibles. While the grind of collecting 1,000 bits and bobs can be cathartic for some, skipping the traditional collectathon here was quite welcome. While most of what I described combines to deliver an engaging experience, there are just a few minor issues. One is that there is a clear 2-second delay between unpausing the game and the game registering the next few button presses. Thankfully, it doesn't last longer than that brief window, but it's definitely there. Another minor gripe is the unimaginative music chosen. There's nothing wrong with traditional African music, but the initial setting, named Amani, left me longing for a glimpse into the modern African metropolis display that players are treated to at the very beginning. A few futuristic or contemporary tracks would have been a nice consolation instead, and one or two SA house tracks would have also been welcome. The campaign is special, not in how it ends, but how it unfolds and the brave leaps it's willing to make in order to explore the well-known 5 stages of grief. My favorite was denial, as Zhao was quick to guide a grieving daughter out of her despair, but he fails to escape its clutches himself when one of his best friends is clearly beyond saving. He even goes as far as lashing out at a companion when he's preoccupied with rescuing his father from death. I'd be hard-pressed to choose between story or gameplay loop in terms of which one did the most heavy lifting, but if I had to, I think gameplay would win out for me. I usually don't play side-scrollers for more than 30 minutes at a time, but Zhao held me and made me put other games on the back burner. The platforming is precise, the puzzles and side activities are engaging and cleverly paced, and I didn't feel like I was completing tasks so much as I was exploring a rich world. Tales of Kenzera Zhao is a great expression of the boundless naivete, bravery, and optimism afforded to the youngest of humans that also showcases cultures and settings that are rarely seen in video games, and does so while delving into the stages of grief with reckless abandon and a positive outlook in an industry hell-bent on aggrandizing endless misery. As such, Zhao is a near masterpiece that embodies the phrase, breath of fresh air in every sense. Final score, 9 out of 10. Patricio Do Rosario. All right, that was his review. Let me know what you thought of that. Was it fun? Was it good? Was it interesting? Was it too long? Was it too short? Would you like me to do that again? Would you like me to not ever do that again? Let me know what you think. All right, that is going to do it for the main portion of our show. And before we go, I usually like to cover a couple non-games things just to kind of fill you in on what I'm doing. Let's see. What do I have on deck this week? Oh, okay. Mostly TV this week. I've been watching a couple shows. First, I've been watching the Absolutely Made-Up Adventures of Dick Turpin, which stars, what is his name? Oh, that's right. Noel Fielding. You may know him, and this is where I know him from, is from the Great British Bake Off. He's the kind of like, I don't know, kind of like stoner, long hair, weird outfit guy who's got like really, you know, like sweet natured attitude. And he very lightly jokes with the contestants as they're making muffins and cakes. I didn't know anything about Noel before I saw him on the Great British Bake Off, but apparently he's, you know, pretty well known in the British comedy scene. And in this TV show, he plays Dick Turpin, who is apparently a historical highwayman in the UK. Again, I'm American, so this is not history that I know, but it's really funny. It's a total just like absurd kind of satire. He plays a highwayman, but he's also a vegan, and they also have like a lot of like, you know, malapropisms and some, you know, things out of time, things that they shouldn't know about. It's all just like jokes and silly situations and funny things and gags. And it's just a really good time. It's ironic because we just watched, what was it called? The Nell show. We just watched Renegade Nell on Disney Plus, which was awesome. And that was all about a highway woman or highway person, I guess. And so it was just kind of ironic that we start watching another show about a highwayman. I mean, how often do you watch shows about that? In America, not very often. So we played these back to back and they were good companion pieces. But it's really funny. I think it's really cute. We were laughing a lot. It's just very, very adorable. Noel is great in this. And I think the supporting cast is really strong too. So Dick Turpin, the what's it called? The completely made up adventures of Dick Turpin is quite good. It's very funny. We're also watching Picard series 3. I can't remember if I mentioned this or not, but after having gone through Star Trek: The Next Generation, the whole series, we watched all 4 movies, which were better than we thought. And then we're starting to watch the Picard series. We jumped straight into season 3 because people said season 1 and 2 was dull. And season 3 has been a banger so far. It's so good. So many exciting twists and turns. So much action. A lot of returning faces. It's kind of like this victory lap for the old TNG crew. It's been really, really good. And we are just like, dang. Like every episode, I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to find out what happens. What is next? It is very good. Picard is super old. Everybody's super old in the show. And that was like a little bit weird because we literally just got done watching Next Generation. And so to see them in their prime, and then the very next time we watch them is like, boom, he's like 80 now. I'm like, whoa, it's kind of a head trip, but also really good. Loving season 3. If you're a Next Generation fan, I can't speak for season 1 and 2, but season 3 is like required viewing. It's so good. So good. Also watching Bodkin. This stars Will Forte, who was in The Last Man on Earth. I don't watch SNL, and so, you know, he was big on SNL. I never watched him there, but I watched him in Last Man on Earth, which is an amazing fucking show. One of my favorite shows of all time. And this is like the next thing that he's done since then. He is playing a podcaster who's down on his luck. He goes to Ireland to do like a, you know, like a local color sort of a thing. And while he's there, he gets teamed up with a Irish reporter who's trying to uncover a story, and they work together. They're very much an odd couple that don't get along very well, but they're in this like really, really small Irish town in the middle of nowhere. And there's some dark shit happening. And it kind of goes back and forth between Will Forte's kind of goofy, lighthearted, jokey stuff. It's not absurd, but he's got a lot of jokes and laughs, but light laughs and appropriate laughs. And then it goes into like darkness and cover-ups and murder. It reminds me a little bit of Deadlock, which we loved last year. Probably my favorite show of last year, where it's kind of like these, that was about two cops investigating small town murder. But also had a very heavy dose of comedy and slice of life. Kind of the same thing here. A little slice of life action. Get the Irish countryside. A lot of booze. But also Will Forte doing his good-natured thing. And then this the other cast members are doing a great job kind of filling in. So it's really, really interesting. Really like it a lot. We're about halfway through. And one of the most unexpected things about Bodkin is that it was executive produced by Barack and Michelle Obama. I'm like, what the fuck? I saw that come up on the title screen and I was like, what? What is going on, dude? So anyway, I guess it's got the former president's seal of approval if he's fucking producing it. I don't know how that happened. So check that out. I think we're watching it on Apple? Or was it Amazon? I can't remember. Whatever. Google it. You'll find it. And the last thing I'll give a shout out to is everybody knows I love 40K. The video games, anyway, the action figures as well, not the tabletop so much. But as we were watching YouTube, my son has gotten into 40K as well because he's like some of the figures that I have, and he's like, I want some of these figures. Got him some figures, and now we're kind of just like geeking out over it. He wanted to watch some 40K content on YouTube, and there's a number of really good animated trailers that do a good job of like, you know, showing the battle scenes and people in their power armor and stuff like that. And as we were clicking through the various shorts, I mean, they're usually like 5, 6, 7 minutes, something like that. We came across one that was like a full length movie. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? It was called Ultramarines, a Warhammer 40,000 movie. And I'm like, is this a fan project? What is, that's a lot of running time. That's a lot of animation. Who in their right mind would do that? So we click on it and it's from like 2010. So the CGI is a little bit dated, not bad. I mean, it's not unwatchable, but you can certainly tell it's older, simple models and stuff like that. Not a lot of background work, but the credits come up and it's got like legit actors. It's like John Hurt. And I'm like, what? John Hurt's in this? Sean Pertwee, Terrence Stamp. I'm like, dude, these are real actors. What is going on? What is this movie? I never heard about this movie. I didn't know what happened. It seems like it got some funding, either from like Australia or New Zealand or something, like one of those artistic funds, I think. And they got like legit voice actors. And I'm like, it just kind of blew me away. So the story is about a group of Ultramarines who need to go to a planet. There's not much on this planet other than like this one monastery, but there's a really important book inside the monastery. They need to recover the book and recover any survivors. And so the Ultramarines get dropped down. They go to this monastery and like just all hell breaks loose. It's actually a pretty classic tale. If you take the 40,000 stuff out of it, it's, you know, basically like, you know, like a horror story where the survivors are getting picked off one by one. There's this evil force and things happen. It's a pretty well put together film. We really enjoyed it all the way through. twists and turns and such. And it was a really great use of the 40K license. And I was just like blown away at like the voice acting, like getting these legit actors in it, like really shocked the shit out of me. So Ultramarines, a Warhammer 40,000 movie. It's free to watch on YouTube. You watch the whole thing. It's like hour and a half, I think. Yeah, it was worth watching. I thought it was pretty good. And I think, checking my script real quick, I think that's it. All right, folks, that is a show. Before the closing music kicks in, I would love for you all to leave reviews, share the show on social media. Most important of all, please recommend So Video Games to your friends, because nothing beats good old word of mouth. If you want to support the show and help out with the cost of running the podcast here, you can do that over at patreon.com/the So Video Games Podcast. And if you'd like to join our Discord, that is absolutely free of charge. Just drop me a line. And, of course, I do love to get questions and comments. Please hit me up, SoVideoGamesPodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach me on social media. It's me on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky under the same handle. It's my name, BradGallaway, all A's, no O's. And this is going to do it for episode 388. Thank you again so much for joining me here on the So Video Games Podcast, and I'll see you next week.